The Truck and Driver podcast is sponsored by Fortune Tires, who manufacture high-quality, durable tires designed for operators who are looking for exceptional value across every application. Fortune Tires is proud to partner with International Tires, the exclusive distributor of their truck tires in the UK. For more info, visit internationaltires.com/fortune or call 0121 552 6888. Drive forward with Fortune Tires.
Hello and welcome to the Truck and Driver podcast. It's Matt Ireland once again, and today I'm joined very excitedly with Paul O'Callaghan down in Australia. How you doing, Paul? All right?
Yeah, I'm doing good, Matt. Thanks very much for asking. Yeah, so we're doing this on Christmas Day.
Yes, we are. Yeah. So,
yeah, it's been a while since our last one. Like someone reminded me earlier on, it's been a fair few months. So yeah, I think we'll definitely have plenty to talk about.
Oh, definitely.
From opposite sides of the world. Sounds like you're a little bit under the weather, so to speak, there.
Yeah, I've got the man flu, unfortunately, so I might be a bit raspy and husky. The one sort of godsend as such about doing day work is I've just been able to get myself home and back to bed sort of quite quickly, which, because it's horrible being ill in a truck, isn't it? You know, when you're away, it's just horrible. So I mean, it's no fun being at home, but at least you've not been sort of stuck in the truck. So I'm definitely sort of feeling a bit better. I mean, I know the last sort of few podcasts I've recorded, I've had this blooming cold, but it sort of finally hit me big time a few days ago. I think when I went to a gig with my family, because my sister's gone down with a similar sort of thing. So I think we just picked up a final bit of virus there somewhere along the line, and yeah, it sort of took me down, but I'm battling through. So I've got a vat of coffee on the go, and I'm sure we'll be fine. Well,
you've got a coffee, and I've just opened a can of Cooper Sparkling Ale here. So
lovely. Why not?
Why not? Exactly. It's Christmas Day.
Exactly. So Christmas Day in Australia, it's obviously going to be similar to here, isn't it? It's going to be cold and wet and whatnot, I presume.
So where I am, I'm in a place called Catherine, as in the name, female's name, in the Northern Territory, and you know, it's a pretty kind of tropical climate up here. So I know usual, like it was on about before, your two seasons, you get your dry season, your wet season, and we're in the wet season now at the moment, Matt. So just hot and sticky and humid.
Yeah,
and you know, it builds up. They have this kind of thing called the build up. You know, where it gets very humid and you get cloud, and then it'll sort of rain, or you get storms, a lot of lightning and thunderstorms and that. So there won't be any storm through this, but generally in the evening. But daytime temperature is about 36 degrees, humidity up at 63%. Yeah, so but no, it's good, you know, just sun all the time. But you really do know if the heat hits you when you open the door. So, yeah,
absolutely. I mean, years ago I went traveling up the east coast of Australia, and where Christmas in Hervey Bay, I think it was, and we kept going north, got as far as Airlie Beach for New Year's Eve, and then the humidity was just crippling, you know, and I'm not sort of built for the heat. And,
look, it takes a little bit of conditioning, but
there's such a
big difference between dry heat
and
the humidity. You can get well up into 30, you know, when it's dry, but you're not actually sweating, whereas when you get the humidity, you're just sweating without doing anything. But anyway, it's all good. It's you know, Catherine, it's about, you know, 300 kilometers roughly south of Darwin.
Yeah,
at a bit of crossroads here. You know, you've got the Stuart Highway and the Victoria Highway, where, you know, the big trucks coming up from kind of the Perth direction, and then you've got all the trucks then coming up from Melbourne and Sydney and you know, that coming the other way, in Brisbane and places like that. So it is a kind of a meeting point for trucks. So it was I just had a quick look, actually, because I was always curious as to where the name Catherine came from. So there was a guy called John McDowell Stewart, who was like an explorer, you know, and he would have been probably one of the first white men to come through here in 1862, and he named the Catherine River after a guy called James Chambers, who was a pastoralist who had came out from England originally. and made quite a lot of money. He seemed to be quite wealthy and financed this guy in his expeditions. And so he named the town after the daughter or the wife of this guy, James Chambers. So I just thought that was an interesting fact about the Catherine. Yeah, but it's been pretty quiet here today. I'm just we've got a depot here, Matt. One of two depots in the Northern Territory. The Darwin would be probably the biggest depot, and there's a depot here where there's two very very important members of staff here, two dogs.
Yep.
That I'm looking after. So the manager.
Fantastic. And
the
partner,
yeah, I'll send you a couple of pictures there. So I know you work with dogs quite a bit. So you'll know they're actually two lovely dogs, very well trained. But I suppose when they're quite spoilt and are used to kind of having the run of the place, so to try and find someone to come in, and they're gone for 5 weeks, so I'll do 2 weeks here. Another driver he'll finish off the rest of it. So it's just quite a nice time to relax here and chill out and
Perfect. Mm. So is that Stuart that you talked about who named Catherine? Is that the guy who the Stuart Highway is named after?
I presume it would be.
Fair enough. So you've been, I mean, so aside from your livestock work, you've sent me a few pictures. You've been doing a bit of my kind of work, a bit of bulk haulage, I see.
Yeah, well, I just sent you through those pictures now just because I knew you'd be sort of interested in that sort of agri sector work that you're often involved in as well. So how it came about was we'd been really busy at the cattle, and then it's such a kind of a, it can be all go, and then all of a sudden it sort of stopped. So once it stopped, I was up in Darwin, and the truck went in for a major service, and then that kind of one thing led to another, and they were talking about valve recession, and to put a long story short, they ended up actually putting a new engine in it. So these Cummins engines, the modern day Cummins engines, don't really seem to last as long as you would expect an engine to last, you know, before they need the heads done or a rebuild. So I was in a spare truck, and work was pretty quiet, and then this job offer came up, you know, within the company to do what they call end tippers, because out here, you know, you don't just say tippers, because side tippers are such a popular thing out here. They'd be almost a lot more common, you know, depending on the area you're in. So, I just said, why not something different? And that was hauling grain from the Northern Territory over to a place called Atherton, quite near Cairns. So a lot of country I wouldn't have travelled before, Matt. Even to pick up the, so I had to get a lift with one of the other drivers down to Mount Isa, which was roughly about 1600 kilometers, where I picked up the truck, and then I went, you know, this is probably the same distance again, probably a bit longer, even 1800 down into Meath and Wales to pick up the trailers. So massive empty running, but that's just how it goes out here. You don't just find a set of end tippers here, and just a customer we're working for had them, and so I spent about a month on those end tippers, and that was actually quite a good job. You know, I was up to over to Cloncurry and up to Normanton and right across the top of Queensland, places I hadn't been before, and up to Cairns then, which was a bit of an eye opener because you had a lot of steep hills there, very very tropical narrow roads. So we were only allowed to go with one trailer up there, so you get the road train assembly area and drop your back to, and then, you know, go with one at a time up to the feed mill we were unloading at. So it was probably like a full day to unload, because each time, you know, you've got to pull out the dolly and, you know, you're hooking all that kind of thing. Took a bit of time, but it was something different, and just a nice, the change is always as good as the rest, as they say.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So it was all just obviously grains from their harvest.
Sorghum was the so it's used mainly for animal feed. So from the area I've been hauling it from, like, wouldn't be a really a traditional kind of a cropping area, you know. It was on the Barclay table, and more so cattle, just fast kind of cattle breeding country, but a lot of black soil there, and the little bit of cropping now starting to creep in. Actually, cotton is getting quite popular up here now in Catherine. They opened a thing called a cotton gin here lately for processing the cattle.
You quite often see.
I think it's quite big over in Queensland, but it's becoming a thing here now. I think it's quite lucrative, and you know, it's not uncommon now to meet trucks with large cotton bales on them. Guys with kind of purpose built trailers with a kind of a frame that sort of, you know, catches or locks in the bales.
Yeah.
So just a kind of difference. There is a farming up here. Mangoes is quite popular. So just something different. Just something different to the cattle. You have a little bit less stress anyway. Compared to transporting animals. And backloaded, then took fertilizer from Townsville. Again, hadn't been over there before. So once after the first week, it was a bit of a learning curve. Everything was a bit new to us, and had a few dramas along the way. Blew a few tires, and probably was a little bit heavier than it should have been. Once we figured out everything, it was went a bit better in the second week, and actually became quite enjoyable. So that's what I've been doing for probably last 5 weeks in a different truck. Obviously I needed tipping gear for that.
I was gonna say, has there been much off road driving with the tip and stuff like we do over here?
So really the only off road was where I was loading, a driveway into a station could be any length. The driveway was about 50 kilometers, and that was a dirt track. And what happened was it rained quite early, a little bit earlier than expected. Access was a problem. And you think of a few pictures, we had a big John Deere, tracked John Deere. I think it was something like a 570 horsepower tracked John Deere on hand with a big sling to drag us through the mud holes. So that was definitely a help. And I think one of the guys was a few of the trucks on the job as well. One of the guys got bogged a day before I arrived there, and it took them 6 hours to get him out. They had two John the track John Deere, and then like an 8 hour John Deere, wheeled tractor and a grader, everything hooked together to pull him out. Because when you're probably about 125 tons, and to try and pull all that over a muddy hole. The thing you find out here is just, people, they'll always find a way somehow, it's because there's no other alternative. You can't just kind of ring people. They'll always, those stations are so resourceful, and guys just stay at it. And I was quite glad it wasn't me,
Absolutely. It just, once again, the distances in Australia just sort of blow my mind, a 50 kilometre driveway as such, down the station. Yeah. And like you said, you've got a lift for 1,600 kilometres to go and pick the truck up. That's 1,000 miles, and then going another sort of 1,000 k's. It's just mad.
And you're right. Like it just becomes, normal out here after a while. Anything can become normal. I had a few problems along the way. Just we were, coolant issues and that was seemed to be, there was quite a few things there, but you just sort them out. The only one I couldn't sort was the air compressor, which probably was pretty weak when I got into the truck, and eventually it finally let go. Lucky enough, I was in Mount Isa at the time, and Cummins were out, and first of all they said they didn't have one in stock, and then they came back and said, we do have one in stock. So it's I've asked guys, when they buy trucks out here, and backup in the remote areas is a big thing. Whatever your preference might be for a particular brand, I think that's vital out here is the backup service. And the thing about I suppose Cummins, they have a really good service network out here.
Yeah.
Even if their latest engines mightn't be lasting to what they should be. You'll always get a part for a Cummins. That's why lads, more or less, stick with them.
Yeah.
The distance out here is
vast, isn't it?
God,
absolutely vast.
It still amazes me, so the areas I'm operating in are just so sparsely populated. Like even when I was telling you there, I blew a couple of tires just because everything runs so hot out here, and because probably a little bit more weight on that I should as well. And the truck I was in, I checked it had a couple of jacks, and then of course went to use one of the jacks and the jack didn't work. But anyway, the first truck that pulled, like the first truck that came along, he stopped because it was on, it's a hazard, like it's a pretty remote road, nobody really else, and passing and how are you going? Do you want a hand, mate? It's like, yeah, actually I could do with a hand. And he came out and, you know, had it, and you just get it done and away you go. And so, yeah, it's great that people do stop out here.
Good old fashioned camaraderie.
Really, really, really is. And that's one of the things I like about out here. And you do the same as well, that just everything, you know, spreads around. You'll have some part of, or something you can do for someone else along the way. And it's not about money. It's just about everybody, which is, there's something nice about it.
Yeah. It's quite surprising that the Cummins don't seem to be quite as reliable, but I think it just seems to be like that globally with everyone's products. Just the amount of breakdowns that seem to happen nowadays, just again, regardless of brand, just seems to be unbelievable, really, from what I see around the UK and Europe, you know, what you see online and the issues that I know people have had with various trucks, and none of them seem to be particularly better than others. I mean, one in particular seems to be a bit worse than any of the others at the moment. I'm not going to mention the manufacturer.
You don't have to, but would they have resolved certain issues with injectors, for example?
Well, I really don't know, is the honest answer. It still seems to be an ongoing issue, unfortunately. And I don't know how it's got to this point, you know, and it's still ongoing. You think if we're a developing society as such and technology is moving ever onwards, how can we not having the quality builds that we seem to used to have? I mean, maybe again, it's the rose tinted glasses that we didn't used to break down as much, but I don't remember when I was a lot younger, starting out driving, people weren't constantly breaking down from my memory.
Would it be anything to do with the shackles that are placed on the manufacturers?
I think it could well be, with the emissions having to do with all that emissions. Sort of thing.
With the actual materials that they're using,
could be
steel and like you said, the emissions. I think that's the same quality is not in the materials anymore.
Yeah.
I
think we could be right. So
I actually called through here a while ago and he's driving a Scania, so a next gen R.
Yeah.
But it's a 620, the older engine.
Yeah,
he's doing quite long distance work. So he's came from Perth and he's up in Darwin. Beautiful, beautiful looking truck, and he's had quite a lot of problems with it. Mm-hmm. Gearboxes and you know, just various things. A lot of problems that he wasn't expecting. And he said the truck is off the road for weeks at a time, and then you get it out and there's still more problems. So
yeah,
you know, it's it must be quite a headache for guys as well, you know, especially when you're going such long distance. You know, he said he loves the truck itself, you know, likes it to drive and all that. But he actually saw, I'll give him a mention, it's Rab Isaac. He originally from Pittenweem in Scotland. Rab listens to the podcast. So yeah, he was walking Christmas Day away from his family, so he's a good hard grafter, hard yakka, as they say out here.
Yeah.
And he came in to call in, and we, you know, normally you're so busy you don't really have much of a chance to catch up. So he finally got a chance and came in here and talked trucks for an hour or so. And yeah, he's on his way again. Yeah, so good.
Yeah, excellent. So, but yeah, and just as another side, like a friend of mine, or his friend, took a brand new Volkswagen Transporter out on a demo before he bought it. And out on the demo drive, the gearbox packed up. And it's just, you just think, brand new demonstrator, and it's packed up. I mean, what faith are you going to have, you know, as a customer to be buying it, you know? And I still think there's a gap in the market, although you could probably never get to do it with the stringent rules and regulations and whatnot. But just for a really simple, basic car, stroke van, stroke truck. So one which has a key for the ignition, you know, that you put in and turn. None of this keyless nonsense, you know, just your bare basic ABS package, the absolute bare minimum in electrics, other than maybe the stereo, and just keep it really, really simple. And I think that could well be a bit of a seller, but
you probably answered that when you began speaking about it, when you said that, you know, the manufacturers are probably constrained and they can't do all these things. You know, I drove earlier on today, I was driving a Toyota Land Cruiser So it's a single cab with the V8 engine. I think it's like a 4.5 liter or something to that effect. Quite a very basic kind of utilitarian work tool. But only, you know, 2024 or 2023 model, either or. Like, they've actually gone, they've brought out a new one now. They've gone away from the V8. They've gone out, they've brought out a new 6-cylinder, 2-liter diesel engine. But anyway, it was just kind of nice to get into something that didn't have any of that new stuff. You know, you just turn the key and there was only 5-speed gearbox and there was nothing apart from the stereo, which you could actually touch. The screen, everything else, you know, the heater controls and the, you know, all that.
Yeah.
Turning knob when you've got the two little levers that slide across. It's just something nice about that. So,
yeah
I generally say after about kind of 2010, with most vehicles and cars, I sort of lost interest once it just got too much touch screeny and all of that. So,
it does seem to be technology for technology's sake, you know, and it's just for maybe it's just because I'm old and, you know, just think, well, we, you know, just like you say, a mechanical slide just to go from hot to cold.
What was ever wrong with putting a key in an ignition?
Exactly. Yeah. I don't get it. You know, and the amount of vehicles seem to get stolen because they can just clone whatever with a computer and drive off.
I know. Look, it's probably been mentioned so many times in the past before about, but you might as well just say it now. Like, as you know, Sam's like, what was wrong with mirrors? What was so wrong? Well, I think it's, they've developed everything else so much. It's like, what can we do next? What can we do next? And we'll put in, and this is these mirrors, and this will save you so many percent of fuel and all this. And it just all becomes very, very boring, to be honest, to me anyway.
Yeah. I mean, I get the fuel saving with margins being so tight, you know, you've got to try and do whatever you can. Certainly over here, I mean, presumably it's quite a different sort of market where you guys are. But yeah, over here we've been very cutthroat. Fuel is, it's got to be on. But then say that, of all the people I work for, only one that I'm aware of actually monitors AdBlue consumption and how much people are actually using, which surprises me with the amount that it actually costs and how much modern vehicles seem to use. And well, I mean, perhaps other people listening to this, perhaps their companies do actually monitor it, but I'm sure I've talked about it before. It just seems to be sort of one of them things. But then diesel isn't just one of them things. Everyone seems so keyed up on diesel consumption, but not on AdBlue. Maybe there's a reason for it. I don't know.
Yeah, well, the mate who was through here a while ago on the R620, that's actually one thing he mentioned was that the AdBlue consumption was very high, and I have heard that from guys before. In the trucks I'm, or those Kenworths there, it can be up or down. Sometimes it uses hardly any AdBlue, and you're thinking, is there a problem with it now? Is the nozzle blocked or something? And then other times it can use more. But the less the better, in my opinion.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And it's quite temperature sensitive as well, isn't it? So I would have thought it'd be ineffective. Some of the temperatures you guys hit, I'm sure it's over about 33 or something, and below minus something. I've read it's ineffective, I believe. I'm sure I read that before somewhere. I can't remember exactly where, and I'm probably wrong, but perhaps it's just using it for no good reason anyway.
Well, I think I was saying before, I know one operator in WA that just really switch it off, you know, and don't worry about the work, because that's the problem out here. You won't get warranty on it
and
if you switch it off. But anyway, that's AdBlue, and that's the modern era. It's not going to go backwards anyway, unfortunately.
No, it's not, mate. It's not.
We just keep living in the past,
we've been
teary-eyed and nostalgic about old trucks. And
exactly, and who doesn't love a pair of rose-tinted glasses, eh?
Exactly. Yeah, it's brilliant.
Yeah. So, have you had any other escapades whilst out on the farm doing your bulk?
Yeah, I was just thinking about that actually when I was bringing that I brought fertilizer back. And I got in, they had an airplane for spreading it. So I'd heard about this, but never really been in, kind of exposed to it or seen it anywhere. And, you know, I never thought I'd actually witness a plane spreading fertilizer, not to mention be actually part of the scene. So when I got to, the first time I got there, they were quite short on storage space. So we were storing it in, you know, these, what they call sausages, Matt. So it's like plastic, round, long plastic tubes, basically, that you you put the product into. Like there's a thing called a bag unloader, and you know, I was flipping into a hopper, and that was going into an elevator and down into it. But the next time I arrived, they were out of storage space. I waited 2 days, 3 nights for the plane to arrive.
Yeah.
So a contract was in, you know. But that's just normal out here. There was nothing really else happening. Last job of the year, and so I had a couple of days waiting at the station. And then this thing called an air tractor arrived.
Right.
So quite interesting, actually. So it's a contractor, you know, they've got a fleet of them. So the air tractors come from America. A guy called Leyland Snow, he started off developing, I think that company was developed in the late 70s. But before the fertilizer plane arrived, there was a guy, spraying crops, their crops had just gone in. And, I was looking at the plane and asking him lots of questions about it because I'd never seen it before. And he said, "Oh, you want to come for bring it for a ride?" Because some of them are a single engine plane, so it's an air tractor 802, the biggest one you can get. And this one had a seat behind. So yeah, of course, I went for a run.
Yeah.
Well, I regretted that decision. I couldn't get on in the flight. So
a bit rough.
Oh, so the G forces. I wasn't expecting that at all, and because the particular paddock we were doing was such a short, by your standard out there, was such a short run. I think we probably turned about 20 times. So he's trying to turn as sharp as possible.
Yeah.
This is to maximize economy. So I think after about the second turn, I kind of knew I was in trouble. And I was, so you're sitting behind him, and I had a headphone on, and I was taking pictures and everything was great. And then I went very quiet and started to sort of get nauseous. And I think he detected it. That he said, "How are you going back there, mate?" "Yeah, I'm not going great, to be honest with you now." And actually, at one point, I had took my hat off, with the expectation that I was actually going to vomit. And then I thought we were nearly finished, And I said, I was just trying to hold it. I was kind of bracing myself for every turn because it was a strange feeling when you're not used to it. And I said, "We must be nearly finished now." He said, "No, we're probably only about halfway." And I looked at the gate. I knew the plane. I knew he could take 3,000 liters. And the gauge, I looked at the gauge, unfortunately, and it said 1,700 left.
Oh, no.
So, I just about managed to hold it all together.
Yeah.
And got back to ground and sort of walked, took a bit of a diversion, went in behind some cotton bales and got down on my hunkers for a while. And I went to bed soon after. Didn't have dinner or anything. But I was delighted. It was a great experience just to see it. So the reason they do it is for speed. Speed is the main reason. I think some planes you can convert them for spraying or for fertilizer. But the guy that came for the fertilizer had a single engine plane. Not that I wanted to get up again anyway.
Yeah.
But I was timing his run, so I think their problem, volume to actually get the product in there. It was urea. It was quite quite bulky. More. I think they were probably getting about maybe two, just in or roughly around 2 ton or a bit more in, and he was back. He was filled up and back in 8 minutes. That was it.
Wow.
Oh yeah. So when you think about it, like, so I had three trailers, probably the guts of 80 tons net there. It didn't take long at all for him to put it out. So he had a teleporter.
Yeah.
With a sort of a bowl, and that was kind of just basically tipping it right into, we were filling that out with the chaser bin. And it was really impressive to see how they did it. And also one of the advantages is if you get wet conditions, of course, and you can't put wheeled machinery over as well. So I think down in places like big cropping areas of New South Wales, these planes are really popular. But anyway, not something you would see in Ireland, and I'm sure it's not something that would be very common in England either.
Definitely not. No. But I think by the time you got up, you'd be long over the field that you're going to try and fertilise, I'd say.
Yeah. Well, one of the paddocks, as they call them there, was 8.5 kilometres long. Yeah.
It's just
so. And I was asking them in acres, but they're talking hectares there, and it was just it was just mind-boggling the scale.
Yeah.
So I've always been quite interested in in kind of agri areas as well, but just, you know, never, it's kind of hard to get much of a chance to be involved. Any chance I can get, I'll have a look. So they had that track John Deere with, I think it like had a 36 meter drill behind it. He was drilling, and then they had a self-propelled John Deere sprayer as well that was going. And that was a little bit of kind of agri work.
I bet you're glad you actually did go up on the plane, even though you weren't enjoying it at the time. At least it's something you've experienced.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, not this, because when I told the other few station workers there, you know, I told them, they were often like, "Oh, geez, no, you don't ever go up on one of them." But I think if I did it again, you know, just be a little bit. At least I'd know what was coming, you know. Never had any problems, but it's such a completely different experience to just taking off and going somewhere on a flight, and just taking off and just going in a straight line. This was it was the turns, yeah. But great to do it, and you know, even like, so they've all those guys in those planes, like they've got to have someone on the ground as well, servicing them. So the guy, you know, who was doing the spraying, he had a service guy, you know, with a Land Cruiser and a trailer. He had his fuel on the trailer, and then he was, you know, he was mixing up the spray as well. And then the guy who was doing the fertilizer spreading, he had a guy helping him that had it. He brought a Kenworth truck with the telehandler on it and the special attachment on the front of it for filling the plane. So it was such a slick operation to observe, you know. Probably pretty expensive, but when a job needs to be done fast and there's bad weather on the way, all hands on deck. Yeah, one point I noticed, he did the wind actually just picked up kind of all of a sudden, and had to do a couple of laps before he was able to land again. But you know, you think a pilot has a kind of a glamorous life. Those guys are working pretty hard, you know, basic just work shorts and boots and no nice, you know, air hostesses to impress with, you know, fancy shirts and uniforms and all that. It looked like hard enough yakka, as they call it out here.
Yeah, I can imagine.
yeah. That's probably all the adventures for now. We're just on a bit of a wind down here, and probably head, you know, go back to Ireland at some point in early January. Actually have a planning another trip up to Norway in probably late January.
Fantastic.
Yeah, I was up there last February with a mate who was a similar passion for trucks and toured around, and we're going to go up there again and take a slightly different route this time, and Cork, basically just the scenery up there is just
stunning, isn't it?
Stunning, yeah, really one of my favorite places. And we'll be going in the middle of winter, and hopefully as much snow as possible. That's what going from one extreme to another, then from out here to there. So that's kind of the next adventure on the cards. What about yourself? Have you any you've got a trip coming up pretty soon, have you?
Yeah, so on the 28th, I'll be flying to Madrid. Van has been left out there by my mate. He left it on Monday. So I'll fly out on the 29th. I'll collect two dogs, and I'll take them down to Geneva, drop them off on the 30th, I think it will be, and then run back up to Paris for a collection, I think, late on the 30th or sort of first thing New Year's Eve, and bring that dog back in to Cambridge, drop it off, and then go home sort of New Year's Eve sort of afternoon. So that'll finish my year off quite nicely. And then so I have New Year's Day off, then back to the normal day work on the 2nd. Then on the 3rd, the dogs that take to Greece every year, they're in the dog hotel in Carmarthenshire. So I'll be collecting them with the same van I'm picking up in Madrid. So I'll go pick them up, take them back to Kensington, drop them off, go to my mates, drop the van off. He'll give me a lift home, and then back to the 9 to 5 as such.
So you said you're driving from Madrid to Geneva, is that correct?
That's right, yeah.
That'll be a nice drive. Will you go through Ventimiglia?
No. So I'll go across Zaragoza and then drop down. I think I'll drop down sort of Barcelona, sort of, you know, Girona, up through L'Agenquera into France, and then just sort of follow the coast along, and then sort of head up at I can't think of the name of it now. but just
you'd be going up. Yeah, I'm just trying to think of the route there. Will you be going? You might get a chance to see a bit of scenery you mightn't normally see. Or,
yeah, hopefully. And then I think it's too far doing one day, I think. So it'll be, you know, find a hotel still in France, and obviously Switzerland's mega money. And then just nip into Switzerland the next day, drop them off. Because it's actually Neon, where there's a festival every year, happens, funny enough, that I've been to in my rock and roll days as such. So drop them off. And with Switzerland and the animals, it's just a case of driving through the car border, show your passport and carry on. I don't think there's any stopping or hassles. Get your road tax. And then back out and then head up for Paris. And hopefully then I'll have a little look and see if I can find a nice little sort of national route that I can wiggle my way up just for a bit of a change. Depending on the weather as well, because if it's dark and wet and horrible, then I'll probably just have an easy life and stick to my way. But I'd like to get off route and have a little look, because there is a nice national that runs down to Belfort from sort of Longres. Choy always used to enjoy doing that sort of cuts. If you head down to Troy and then it sort of cuts off a big lump of it, that was always nice in the truck.
You're pronouncing Longres probably as it should be, very French and correctly. If you were driving and talking earlier, you call that Langres.
Langres, absolutely. Langres. Troy's.
Troy's, and it's probably Trois or something like that, but you don't want, of course. The risk is always the sounding pretentious, you know?
That's right, yeah. And I always think, I'll try and pronounce it sort of roughly right. I'm sure somebody who speaks French fluently will probably say, yeah, completely wrong. It's a bit.
Either way, you'll always be wrong in their eyes anyway.
Yeah, it's like in Sweden, like Jon Koppen.
Jon Koppen.
It's something like Schönköping or something, and Gothenburg is it like Göteborg, and it's just all these ones. You just think we must just sound terrible trying to pronounce these.
Oslo, I think, is Oslo or something.
Yeah,
like.
Yeah, and but it always makes me laugh as well, because you know, we get it with the UK place names as well. We get. Remember, there was once a chap phoned up for a quote for Higgy Wickombe. So where is he? Was it Higgy Wickombe? Oh, High Wycombe was a Higgy Wickombe. And the Dutch always used to pronounce Slough as Schlaw.
Which is
to Schlaw. So, but then when you look at like Bruff up north, you know, it should be bro, maybe, or be exactly. Stuff, you know, who am I to?
And even you know, when we just stick on the English language alone, I could never figure out how Edinburgh is called Edinburgh.
Yes. Or Worcester.
Worcester.
Worcester. Worcestershire sauce.
There's probably countless. Other ones, there was Nijmegen in Holland. I was calling that Nijmegen for too long as well, until I figured out what it was.
Yeah, and I think the one that used to catch a lot of people out when they started doing European was Florence in Italy. Because it's on the map as Firenze, isn't it? So,
there's been stories of, you know, in the pre-internet days of guys going the completely wrong direction, because you could get a town name, you know, the same name on opposing sides of a country. So
yeah,
and especially in I think is it France, you know, you always have that kind of an area code after it.
Yeah,
with the old Michelin map, you'd make sure that was correct as well, lest you go in the completely wrong direction.
I wonder who would be brave enough to admit to some of the biggest sort of mistakes they've made with something like that. It'd be quite an interesting subject. Well,
the time has probably passed long enough now that I'm not sure what the exact time frame is, you know, to be able to sort of admit to your past mistakes. Maybe we should do another podcast about that sometime.
Yeah, we could do. Yeah, I mean, whether anyone would actually admit to getting it wrong or not is another thing.
No, well, even yours and mine, you know, I have a couple I could definitely come forward with, you know. I think there's a sufficient amount of time has passed now, would it be. Definitely, 20 years or more. So it's what they call the caveat, or the timeline is gone.
That's right. Yeah, the statute of limitations. Mm. It's well and truly gone.
That's actually a better way of putting it. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So whilst we've got our rose-tinted glasses on, one of our favourite subjects to chat about is obviously some of the older show trucks. And as we were talking about before we came on air, some fantastic pictures appeared on a particular Facebook group very recently, haven't they, from an old Scottish truck list, wasn't it?
Yeah, when you mentioned to me on air, when you talk about old trucks, the first thing that came into my mind were pictures from a guy called Chris Gandy, if someone might know him, or maybe listen to the podcast from Truckfest Scotland in 1996. Absolutely fantastic collection of photographs from, you know, what was in our eyes probably at least, you know, one of the glory days of trucks and trucking, when you still had that nice variety of truck brands. And, you know, I just noticed, I can't remember, with some Scottish hauler, he had had like FL10s and PCAB 113s, you know. It was just such an honest time. And actually, I had a friend lately who came out with a comment, and it sort of stuck with me, and he said the 90s was the last true decade.
Yeah.
I just thought there was just something nice about it. But yeah, fantastic photographs. You can probably talk about some. I have some favourites from that time as well.
Yeah, and it was just nice to see some of the old liveries as well that have long since disappeared. Even like a really mundane one, like one that caught my eye was Redland. Were they Redland aggregates? They're just like this limey sort of flat green. I think they would have got bought by, I can't remember whether it's Tarmac or somebody like that. And as I said, an Atkinson Strato flat cab. It's obviously a franchise haulier to Redland in this green, and it's just like that. Just sort of summed up the era of the time when you had all these like independents with, you know, trucks they really looked after. I mean, you do still get them nowadays, but it just doesn't seem to be as many. And the liveries are, that's all just sort of, you know, more accountant white and not as interesting as such.
perfect example is up in Scotland now, that DR McLeod's, I was looking at it, you know, somewhere lately, that you know, it's that livery will soon be a thing of the past, judging by, you know, the latest editions, which are in this just drab, like you say, corporate kind of accountants, you know, factory navy with a DFS logo. And you know, there's just something lovely about looking back at those old liveries. Glen D was another one.
Yeah. Just a simple but effective livery, and it's just, I know it comes down to like the resale of vehicles now, and if, I suppose if you've got it on lease, you're more like to wrap it rather than actually paint it. But I mean, the Scottish and the Irish, in my eyes, have always generally had just amazing livery, sort of more so than the English firms as such, in my opinion. Especially the Scottish with like their tartans and so on and so forth. They've just always been really, really eye-catching. And you don't seem to see quite as much these days, which is a bit of a shame.
Yeah, exactly. The company I was thinking of, I was just saying about, you know, the FL10 and a couple of 113 PCABs, is J.A. Alexander. I'd never seen them before, and, you know, they're not sure exactly where they were in Scotland. But one which really caught my eye was, it must have been on the Renault demo truck, and it was Renault Magnum 560. So right. I presume that must have been when the V8 560 was launched, or had come out in 1996, because wasn't that many 560s around?
No. People over here never seemed to really go for the big power, did they? For a long time.
You know, even when the Magnums were new, you know, you had plenty of 500 V8s and 520s. And actually, just on that, did you see there was a picture of a couple of, do you remember the Magnum Williams edition?
Yeah.
There was two of those at the show with consecutive regs. Now, I don't know whose trucks they were, but that was quite a nice special edition in that kind of a metallic blue color. There was one, I remember there was one in Trucking International magazine one time, but they were, you know, pretty early Renault Magnums as well, you know, sort of, it was a special edition connected to the, obviously the Williams racing team, but quite sort of different now, you know.
Mm. And another livery that's now, I believe, long gone, which unfortunately was JB McBean. They always had some really striking ERFs, didn't they? They used to be a magazine called Trucking Class that came out around Christmas time. Now, I remember there being one in there.
That's what I remember from it. I would have read, and they had the logo. I'm pretty sure it would have been hand painted, and the McBean was done in a kind of a slope, you know.
That's right,
Maybe the Mac was small and went a bit bigger, but I presume sold out or you know, became part of someone else. There was another truck as well there. William C. Hocken. Do you remember that F12?
Yeah, from Barnstaple. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so he was quite a long way from home, you know, from Devon. Well, he obviously got a load up there. I see he had the trailer as well, but he was quite a regular show goee with that F12 Globetrotter.
Yeah. It was a tag axle, wasn't it, I think, from memory? A
tag axle, yeah. Melvin Zitson was the driver's name. Just the things you remember. And on the Volvo stand, when you were talking about old liveries and someone that's gone now, there was McCaskill of Stornoway with a new FH12, I presume. Yeah, and then there was GNS International, you know, both of them with FH12 XLs.
Yeah, yeah. I can't remember what happened to GNS. I think they got bought out by somebody, didn't they? I think.
Yeah, they were quite a big. I remember reading about them in the magazine. Do you remember there was a long distance diary and there was a guy called Willie the Bandit?
Yeah.
He was going to Spain in a 144 460.
Yeah.
And I would have read that, and I would have read it and looked at it and wondered, and you know, that was one of those articles that you never forget.
Yeah. Yeah. And back in the great days, as we're sort of just talking about.
Oh, of course, yeah.
And I'll tell you one other that really caught my eye with these pictures that Chris Gandy put up was there's an F-16 Rigid. I don't know if Robert Frame, hay and straw. So in a subsequent post in another group, I think he posted some pics of it as a drawbar. So it started life as a track unit, then got stretched into a rigid for straw. And that's certainly quite a unique vehicle, really. I can't imagine there was any other F-16 rigids in the UK at the time.
I actually, when I saw the picture of that, I was kind of dubious, you know, was it an F-16 or was it a, you know, was it a badge? Because an F-16, but that truck was originally new to David Forrest.
Right.
As a four, but you know, a flat cab 4x2, and I suppose the tractor unit, and then it was stretched. And the other rigid, which I'm sure you'll remember well, again, started out as a tractor unit and was quite bizarrely, like an F-16, you know, 4x2 track unit that was made into a rigid as well, was Steve Tongs.
Yeah. Yes, I remember that in the magazine now, yeah.
Was
it a tipper rigid?
A tipper, yeah.
Yes.
6x2 tag, so not 100% sure if the tag was added on after, but yeah, he had been, it's just changed what he was doing from obviously, you know, articulated work to and converted into a tipper, which was bizarre.
Yeah, but I mean...
also quite cool.
Yeah, it's certainly unique, and again, it's just that sort of thing just doesn't really happen anymore, does it? It's all you wouldn't bother investing that much money in a second-hand vehicle. Because
you know, even as far as like, you know, we did one before, you know, we talked about high roof conversions and all that. And I think all of that work is probably just you can just buy a lot of these trucks off the shelf now, and it's just so expensive to get people to do work like that. But the thing that what it led me to wonder was there ever a new F-16 rigid sold in the UK? And I for one haven't seen any pictures, and I doubt there was from just going on the evidence I've seen.
I would say no, personally. I think they sold in such low numbers, and rigids weren't really a huge market as such, were they? Not, certainly not that high end.
No, unless you were doing maybe hay and straw or
a bit
of livestock, but no.
Yeah, I would say not. Certainly not with a 16. So, whereas in Europe, and especially Scandinavia, it's quite a common thing. So,
even when you go down to Italy, I remember being down with you doing livestock before, and a lot of the weighbridges you were going to, like little co-ops and farms, they were set up for rigid and drag. So you'd weigh, just short, and you'd weigh the rigid and you'd weigh the drag trailer. So if you went in there with an Arctic combination, you were sort of going against the grain a bit, and you'd have to drop, just wind down the legs and unhook from the trailer and weigh it and go through the whole process again. So yeah. He was quite big on rigid and drags.
Yeah. And, I mean, quite a lot of these F-16s ended up in Greece. And some are still working. You still occasionally see some of them still working away. And again, and even after the F-series into the FH is, very sort of popular in Greece, as actual drawbars, A-frames, drawbars rather than a wagon and drag.
A lot of stuff would have went down to Scandinavia, and even Austria, a lot of stuff from Austria ended up down in Greece as well. And of course, the Austrians were no strangers to big power, F-16s, and especially 143s, especially the 500 model. So a lot of those would have went from Austria to Greece, and some continue to work down there as well.
Yeah. And speaking of the 143, it's interesting how they seem to sell an awful lot more in the UK, just from an outsider point of view, than like the F-16 offering. It seemed the 16 from Volvo seemed like quite a unique sort of truck compared with the 143. There just seemed to be an awful lot more 143s about. I don't really know why that is.
Well, I've said this before, and I still stand to be corrected, that there was never a new F-16 sold in the Republic of Ireland. There was a handful sold up in the north, which probably came under the jurisdiction of the UK. But I was, I was trying to find out why, and I think the idea was, what would you want one of them for? And it would have meant then that maybe they would have had to carry, parts and just kind of too much hassle. But I think it sort of created this, and maybe they were, look, I'm not sure, maybe they were, whether they were right or not, to do it, but it sort of gave Scania this whole sort of thing where if you wanted a high power truck, well, it was automatically, you just went to Scania, and when you see nowadays, it's, they've continued that thing on with the V8, and, everyone wants a V8, and everyone wants to have the 770, whether it's required or not. But whereas if you go to somewhere like Scandinavia, it was just normal, to have an F-16 or a 16 liter, maybe just slightly bigger weights and that kind of thing as well. So, but yeah, you're definitely right. There was a lot more 143s.
Yeah, and it's done Scandinavia the world of good, really, say with the following that they've got. But it just seems strange that you wouldn't have, you've got the available tool for direct competition at the high end, and it just never really sold in great numbers.
They probably got a reputation for being quite heavy on fuel as well.
Probably.
That was the first thing when you mentioned an F-16. But I suppose to look at a positive for nowadays, it makes them a lot more exclusive as a collector's truck.
Yeah. Yeah, true.
Especially right hand drive, like you try and find an F-16 now. Well, go and try and find a right hand drive one. Globetrotter, quite rare. Whereas you'll have to go left-hand drive, whereas, and also because I suppose, the Scanias weren't that desirable, especially the V8s for the export market. There's so many of them left around, they just weren't wanted.
Yeah. Which is a bit of a shame, isn't it? But to my mind, I think the best looking of the Scanias is the 143 or the 113 Streamline, the 3 Series Streamline. I think it's still, personally, I think it still looks like a modern truck. I think it's aged really well.
I'm going to, just interesting that you say that now, because there was one more truck I wanted to bring up before we go. And it also came up in those photographs, and it was also featured in a magazine. A truck that I would have looked at was the Terminator 3.
Yes.
Yeah, 113. Was that, now am I wrong in saying, was it the company's name that did fruit and vegetable? Was it AJ Simpson?
I thinks I'm
not a, and there was an AJ Simpson with an FH12 Globetrotter XL,
yeah.
But anyway, it was quite a impressive paint job of obviously Terminator 3. So that's what you were on about. 113 yes. Streamline, proper streamlined skirts, all yeah. of that. Now there was just one thing I had, one question I had about. It had a 113 400 badge. Now, as you're aware, the 400 was the turbo compound model.
Yeah.
Which was quite rare. And there have been guys in Ireland known to badge up a 113 360 with a 400 badge.
Right.
And in the comments anyway, so when whoever this, you know, it was quite a famous show truck with its livery and all that, someone put up a picture of that 113. Did you see that with a tag axle added onto it?
Somewhere I did, yeah, because I was just having a quick look at some of the pictures, and it's got a fifth wheel cover that you just about make out. I think it's AJ and G Simpson of Aberdeen.
There we go.
And I think it then got sold to somebody else in Aberdeen, and then it ended up down where I am in Suffolk, pulling trailers out of Felixstowe, I believe. And I think wow. I might know who operated it at that time, possibly. I'll have to make some inquiries, because it's one that I'd love to cover for the Vintage Vault. So if anyone's got any information on it, please get in touch.
I'm looking here. The reg was J947 CRS, and in the picture with subsequent owners to Simpsons, it's got the 113 badge, and on the other side of the grill, it says 360.
Right.
So I reckon the 400 badge was more than likely a bit of a ruse, you know, and
yeah.
whoever got after then, and they've added a tag axle onto it, but the turbo compound was 400 was quite rare, and also you know, in around that time they were also doing, you could also get a 143 400, which would have been a detuned version of the 14 liter V8.
Yeah.
So here we go.
It's food for thought, isn't it? So it'd be interesting to see.
People like us, it is anyway.
Yeah, be interesting to see what it actually is. So if we can find out, that'd be great.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, like I said, the 400s were quite rare. So is there any other ones there that that caught your eye? Sorry, just to finish, when you said your favorite would be the you know, 113 Streamline, I have to say, I do quite like the look of a what they call a steel bumper, or
yes.
you know, if you're from a certain part of Ireland, you call it the half door 143 top line.
Yeah,
tabs just set up a little bit higher on them, and pre Streamline. So
yeah.
I'd probably come for a bit of flack for that, you know, because you're supposed to take sides and all these things, and you can only stand by one brand, Matt, you know.
That's right. So I've like got
a stop. You can't just be a genuine truck enthusiast.
No, that's right. I mean, you know, so I'll have to say I do apologise, and I don't like the Scania at all, then, because I'm a Volvo man. I have to stick with that. And
I thought you were a daft man, actually, when we really boils down to it. But we just say you're a lorry man. How about that?
Yeah, I'm just a lorry man. I'm an enthusiast of all, even Renaults.
Well, of course, yeah. Well,
of course.
You know, Renault Magnum. Yeah, I'm just not. I'm just not as gone on the on the T range.
No,
I do lament the passing of the Magnum. I know things have to pass. Time moves on, and I've never really spent enough time in one. I just drove one for a quick spin, but I'm not sure if I'd you know, get the same sort of gooey feeling as I would with a Magnum.
No, you wouldn't. I mean, and I know my mate Ash Redman, who listens to this, will be upset to hear it, but yeah, because I drive a T range on a daily basis, and I don't want to be too unkind, but they're not. They just lag behind other things on the market at the time. They have, my biggest bugbear with them is the steering position. It's just because mine's a bit, the two I drive are a bit of an older one, and you can't get the steering wheel sort of anywhere near move like you can in, say, a DAF, Scania, anything like that. That has improved with the later models.
Yeah, but of course.
It's just still just like the digital dash looks dated, and just the layout to me isn't brilliant. And, you know, it just could be an awful lot better. you know. So, but you know, it, having said that, and what we were talking about a lot earlier with reliability, they have been fantastic. I mean, I've been covering this week's sit cover at Chapman's is now well over a year in, and haven't had a single issue. I know I don't do a huge amount of miles, but both trucks, they've been faultless, really.
And I think wasn't warranty one of their big kind of selling points? I know in Ireland there was guys, you know, talking about, were you getting something like a 4 or 5 year, you know, warranty that you weren't getting, like double or whatever you weren't getting on other trucks? And that was a big attraction to the Renaults. Plus the backup, you know, seems to be pretty good.
Yeah, definitely. I think so. And, you know, if I was mad enough to actually think about going out as an owner driver, I would seriously consider buying one just on the back of the reliability of what I've been driving. Although, like I say, the comfort level and whatnot, I don't think is up there. At the end of the day, you can live with that if your truck's not going to be off the road all the time, sort of thing.
Well, this is what it all boils down to. And even, yes, you know, I mean, you're looking at things with tractors and these, you know, various YouTube channels, and like it all, it seems to be about, you know, reliability and even backup, you know, both of those things seem to be the big thing. But again, you know, I just said, like, I'd have to really go and do a trip in one and spend a bit of time in one before I could comment. Are you in a T normal or a T high?
This is a T normal. So I don't think I've even been in a T high, to be honest, and they're probably an awful lot better. It would be total overkill for what I do. I don't need anything that big. So what I do is what I've got is perfectly adequate. So it's just, obviously, you know, everyone will find fault with what they've got, and it would just, you know, just make your day a little bit more enjoyable if it was a bit more comfortable and the radio was a little bit more better. But
yeah, of course, yeah. You know, I set into it like a T normal one time, and I just found you're kind of quite close to the windscreen. I just wasn't overly keen on the driving position. But anyway, look, everyone has their own preferences and you know, allegiances, and but it's I think it's quite good. You know, it's quite nice to try them all. There's quite a lot of the new trucks now that I haven't really got a chance to try. You know, I'm getting a little bit kind of just embedded in the Kenworths, and I have to say I do, you know, really, really enjoy driving them. There's a nice driving position, plenty of leg room, and I'd like that. You know, you've got everything is, you know, old style gauges and the split windscreen and all that, and it's
enjoyable.
It's just enjoyable and old fashioned.
Yeah. Yeah, fantastic. So you said you're coming back to Ireland in January.
Yeah.
Trip to Norway. Are you hanging about in Europe for a while, or are you straight back to Oslo?
I'll come back and I'll do another season next year. I've invested in a subwoofer for that truck. So I'll probably have to come back and do a little bit more time just to at least get the value out of that. I haven't got a chance to put it in yet. That's over where on the other side of Australia where I'm supposed to, where I left in September. Anyway, it's over there. As to when, you know, I'll come back. Last year, last couple of seasons, it was very early April. I kind of hope it's around then as well, which will give me, you know, that'll give me about kind of 3 months off. So, you know, 9 months on, 3 months off. If it's all weather dependent, Matt.
Yeah.
If they don't get any rain, well, you know, you might get some hungry cattle, and they could be looking to move cattle a bit sooner than that. Everything is just so volatile out here.
Yeah.
You know, especially, you know, sometimes the markets, like all this stuff is live export to Indonesia, and it depends on when the permits are released to go there. So it's all every season is different here. And I think that's one of the things I like it, but you know, it sounds like, oh, it's, you know, it's a great job. You've got 9 months on, 3 months off. And in a way it is, but when you're on, you're on. Like, there's not really any time. Okay, you get your week rest and all those kind of things. But as far as actually wanting to go anywhere and have some time off, doesn't happen. You know, you're committed.
Yeah.
They want to, because they have to move. They have to, you can imagine having, you know, the gear is parked up for long enough during the season. So really, they have to maximize it, and everyone wants to get the cattle shifted when they're able to during the dry season and that. So yeah. You kind of make the most of the time off then. So it'll be anywhere from 2 to 3 months anyway. And and back into it again then, hopefully hopefully refreshed and with new sounds to listen to with a better bit. No, so yeah,
marvelous.
looking forward to it. Yeah, what about yourself? What's the any major changes on the horizon, or keep going?
Nothing planned at the moment. I suppose there'll be the usual Greek trip, July. Hoping Dougie might invite me along for a few of these test drive days next year. You never know, do you?
You've definitely put in enough hard yards on the podcast now. Anyway, that should be. Your name should be at least be in the running there.
Just hope to be out of the bottom three by now, surely. So, Chapman's have asked me to sort of, cover ongoing, which is lovely. I've said it before, they're great people to work for. It's nice and easy. But I have got a mate of mine who can cover for me for like a week or so at a time if I need to go off and do something else. So I could just, get it all set up so I can just go and do something just for a week or so, just to go and have a little look at something else sort of thing. But it also works well with giving me the time for like book research. And like I said, the Vintage Vault thing is just so enjoyable to work on. I'm happy just to be plugging away at that. It's just great fun. So
I'm going to have to catch up on a few of those. So I've spent enough time on screen, so I have a digital subscription. But when I go back to Ireland, I'll have all the paper copies, and I'm looking forward to catching up on all of those anyway.
Lovely old job. Yeah, perfect. So, well, hopefully, when you're back, we shall actually have a catch-up in person, perhaps. That'd be nice, if there's time.
I'll definitely have plenty of time on my hands anyway. Yeah, are you into motorbikes as well? Yeah, I see you had a picture of a motorbike in one of your latest.
Yeah, I've got a 1200 Bandit, I've got a Royal Enfield Himalayan, and a fleet of vintage mopeds, like Honda. Two Honda MT5s, Honda C50, C70, C100, 110, CT200, Rally Runabout, BSA Aerial 3. Pooch MS50, that might be it. There might be one or two more. I can't remember exactly.
I didn't know that. I didn't know you were into bikes until I just saw that. I saw the Bandit on. You had a picture of it in front of the Renault in one of the updates.
Just lovely to ride to work in the summer. It's just fantastic. Then when you finish, just gonna have a little pootle about around some lanes and just enjoy it. Yeah, it's great.
Oh, lovely. Yeah, well, bikes are, they're so easy to store, at least. That's one of the things. Yes. They're easier than cars and trucks. So yeah, I've got, it's just Fireblade and Blackbird. So I'll probably get the Blackbird out when I go home. That's the kind of go-to.
Lovely.
So yeah.
Fantastic.
Looks like we're gone over our time.
We have, mate, and we must let you go and have your Christmas Day beer.
Yeah. Well, I'm sort of halfway through it there now.
Fair enough.
Yeah, you'll probably have a few yourself later on, will you?
Yes, that's the plan. I'm hoping perhaps pop to the local pub because he's open from 12 till 2. Have a quick drink, then come back, cook some lunch, and generally call it a day. Really, I'm actually doing a vintage moped run on the 27th, and then. Got a Kepsto Freight reunion again on the evening of the 27th, and then fly to Madrid, and that's my sort of Christmas over.
Very nice. Sounds good.
Yeah, busy. So all good, okay. Mate.
Well, to catch up with you anyway.
It's been an absolute pleasure, Paul. Most enjoyable as always. And truck on safe down under in the sunshine. Keep us updated with some pictures. I'm sure there'll be something in the magazine soon as well.
Yeah, there always is. Yeah, I sent the latest one in there. It's probably not as detailed as what we spoke about there, but always taking a few pictures as I go along, Matt, and something to look back on in years to come.
Definitely. So, all right, mate, we'll enjoy that Christmas Day beer, and we'll catch up with you soon, Paul.
Yeah, same to you. Very lovely. Nice.
Cheers, mate. See you soon. Matt.
See you now. Bye.
Happy Christmas, mate. Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Truck and Driver podcast, sponsored by Fortune Tyres. Fortune Tyres and International Tyres, bringing you innovation and reliability to support your operation. Learn more at internationaltyres.com/fortune or call 0121 552 6888. Drive forward with Fortune Tyres.